Did you know that Wisconsin's Supreme Court once declared a federal law unconstitutional and defied the U.S. Supreme Court to force compliance with it? Well, that's just one of the many instances of Wisconsin law affecting federal law, and we'll hear about a lot more of them. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Joseph A. Ranney, the professor of Wisconsin Law and Legal Institutions at Marquette University Law School, and a partner in the firm DeWitt, Ross & Stevens in Madison. He's also the author of several books, including Trusting Nothing to Providence, A History of Wisconsin's Legal System, and published in 2017, Wisconsin and the Shaping of American Law, published by the UW Press. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. I'm glad to be here.
Well, there's always been this push-pull, thanks to our Constitution, about the relationship between the states and the federal government. That applies, too, to the judiciary. But the federal courts and federal laws existed long before there was a Wisconsin as a discrete territory. So what was the relation when Wisconsin becomes a territory, or even before that?
Well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Norman, got into a big dispute with the U.S. Supreme Court over slavery in the 1850s, and that was the culmination of a number of disputes between the Supreme Court and various states throughout the course of the 19th century. Back at the time of the original Federal Constitutional Convention in 1787, there was a debate as to whether the federal government was strictly a creature of the states, so that the states had equal authority with federal courts to say what laws were constitutional, or whether, as Alexander Hamilton, for one, argued, the federal government was a direct creation of the people of the United States and was independent and, to some extent, above the states. For example, there was a debate over the Alien and Sedition Acts, which most of us have read about in our high school and college history courses, around 1800. And several of the states wanted to nullify those acts because they felt they were an infringement of free speech. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison wrote resolutions for the Kentucky and Virginia legislatures arguing that those states had the power to essentially nullify federal law and nullify any U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding the law. There were other fights, and ultimately it came to be Wisconsin's turn in the 1850s. Very briefly, in 1850, in order to avert secession and civil war, Congress passed a series of laws called the Compromise of 1850. Again, something I think everybody has heard about in high school or college, but not too many people are sure what it exactly is. One of the parts of the compromise was a fugitive slave law that, for the first time, required state and local law enforcement officials to assist federal officials in capturing slaves who had escaped to the north and returning them to their owners down south. Several efforts were made in other states to get the fugitive slave law declared unconstitutional, but state Supreme Courts across the country, including, for example, Massachusetts's court, Massachusetts being a hotbed of abolitionism, said, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that under our federal system. The U.S. Supreme Court has said this law is okay, and we must defer to the high court. Wisconsin was the only state that said no. In 1854, in a case called the Booth case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said the law is unconstitutional, for example, because it does not provide for a right of jury trial. But most important, we don't have to defer to the U.S. Supreme Court. We are a sovereign state, said our Supreme Court. We can make our own decision.
A difference between Massachusetts, where, say, Ralph Waldo Emerson took such violent issue with the Fugitive Slave Act in his journals, and Wisconsin, Massachusetts was one of the states that actually existed as a sovereign state before the Constitution was ratified. So how could this entity formed after the fact take issue with the law of the country that had formed it?
Well, that was really kind of the genius of the federal system. Wisconsin was originally formed under the Northwest Ordinance. That was passed back in 1787, right around the time that the Constitution was enacted. The Congress provided for kind of a unique colonial system in world history. This was the first time that colonial territory of an existing nation, in this case the Eastern Seaboard United States, was allowed ultimately to develop into states on its own, such that those states would become fully equal to states that already existed. So Wisconsin, you might say, took advantage of its status as a sovereign state, thanks to the Northwest Ordinance, to say our opinion is just as good as the U.S. Supreme Court's and maybe better on this issue.
Was this ever resolved? Because just 7 years later, of course, the Civil War breaks out and the whole ball game is different.
That, in fact, is what really resolved it, Norman. It's interesting. After the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided the Booth case, federal authorities in Wisconsin appealed that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. And about 5 years after the original decision was issued, in 1859, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed, that is, overturned the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision. Now, the problem was that the U.S. Supreme Court decision was written by Roger Taney, the Chief Justice who just a couple of years earlier had issued the Dred Scott decision, essentially holding that black Americans have no rights which white Americans are bound to respect. Needless to say, Chief Justice Taney was not real popular in Wisconsin in 1859. So, kind of an extraordinary thing, when he sent his decision to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, normally state Supreme Courts just file and obey U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Well, not this time. The Wisconsin Court took a vote and voted not to file Roger Taney's decision and to defy it. One justice, a fellow named Luther Dixon, who later became Wisconsin's Chief Justice, dissented, basically saying, I don't like the fugitive slave law either, but the Supreme Court in Washington has spoken and we must defer. Otherwise, if you have at that time 30 independent states with 30 different opinions of the validity of this law, we're going to descend into chaos. But ultimately, the debate continued in Wisconsin, and it was not resolved until the Civil War made the whole issue moot.
So it actually never was declared, I suppose, by the later amendment to the Constitution, but was de facto, this fugitive slave law was overturned?
Right. I believe it was repealed during the Civil War after the Republicans took control of Congress.
Do we have other instances then at that time, as we get into the later 19th century, of Wisconsin law actually getting a head start on federal law? Affecting federal law?
We have many instances. Let me just give a couple of highlights. The states' rights battle actually did not completely end with the Civil War. It continued in Wisconsin afterwards. During the Civil War, the relationship between the federal government and the state governments was transformed. The federal government grew tremendously. They had to create a huge standing army to fight the war. They had to reform the nation's financial system in order to finance the war. By the end of the war, with victory, the federal government was kind of permanently acknowledged as being the most powerful government in the country. The states really took kind of a subordinate role at that point. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court, for about 10 years after the war, fought the U.S. Supreme Court and tried to strike down several federal laws that had expanded federal courts' jurisdiction after the war at the expense of the states. In the early 1870s, several of those cases were appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled definitively that no, the U.S. Supreme Court has the final say as to the constitutionality of federal and state laws under the federal Constitution. In fact, a case out of Wisconsin called the Tarbell case is regarded as the definitive case on that subject and remains so to this day. But you asked me whether Wisconsin had been a pioneer in other respects. Obviously, Wisconsin was a pioneer during the Progressive Era. I think we've all studied that in our Wisconsin history courses in school. One of the things I looked at for this book, Norman, was I asked myself the question, well, Wisconsin, under Fighting Bob La Follette, passed an incredible variety of reform laws, but there was a national progressive movement at the same time. It wasn't just Wisconsin. So were we truly leaders? And it would take too long today to give you all the examples of why that's true, but I did conclude that although Wisconsin had a lot of company in passing progressive reforms, Wisconsin truly was the national leader in that respect. I think the pride that we take in our state's progressive heritage is justifiable. One other area where I think we were pioneering is this. One of the interesting things in writing this book that we're talking about for me was discovering a number of people I had never heard of before and realizing what an important role they've played, not only in Wisconsin law, but in Wisconsin history in general. A classic example of that is the gentleman who was Wisconsin's chief justice during the Progressive era. His name was John Winslow. There was a great deal of concern among Bob La Follette and other people who were assisting him in creating Wisconsin laws as to whether those laws would survive a constitutional examination by the courts. There was a legal doctrine that was very popular among many judges at the time called substantive due process. That basically said courts are allowed to look very skeptically at reform laws to see whether they deprive businesses, corporations, other people of their liberty to make contracts with workers as they see fit or to deprive them of their property.
That sounds very current.
It is. Everything old is new again, it seems like. Anyway, before Winslow became Chief Justice, the Wisconsin Supreme Court had actually struck down several reform laws, and there was concern that they would continue to do so. So finally, Winslow became concerned about this. He went on a speaking tour, basically talked to progressives and said, look, you have to understand most judges don't have a political agenda. We are genuinely trying to apply the Constitution as we see it. But he also went to opponents of the progressives and said, look, you have to realize he was not a fan of what is called constitutional originalism, which many judges still advocate today. He said you cannot interpret the Wisconsin state constitution or the federal constitution based on what people thought in 1787 or, in our case, 1848 when we became a state. Constitutions have to be interpreted flexibly to adjust to changing times. And he said to conservatives in Wisconsin, you need to allow some play in the joints here. If you do, you are going to have the progressives making an attack on the structure of government itself, and that would be a bad thing. So after that, the Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld several major reform laws. For example, Wisconsin's workers' compensation law. We were the first state to have a constitutionally functioning workers' compensation law. The court also upheld, for example, a law called the Industrial Commission Law, which created the nation's first workplace safety agency. It really was one of the keystones of modern administrative law. So in my view, John Winslow, he's not known to very many people today, but he is a tremendously important figure in Wisconsin history.
So one of the upshots then in the realm of safety, for example, seems to be that, yes, these agencies do have the right to review practices of these businesses as a constitutional phenomenon or ability for these government agencies to take part in the relations between businesses and their employees.
They do. And one of Winslow's additional contributions was there was a question whether when the progressives built these brand new agencies, they were allowed to delegate rulemaking powers to agencies. Many courts previously had held no. Creating safety regulations, creating workers' compensation regulations is a policy issue that only the legislature can handle. There was a real doubt as to whether those powers could be delegated to administrative agencies, and Winslow was very important in persuading his colleagues to say, yes, they can.
So there was a challenge, a constitutional challenge to the workers' comp law and some of the other laws that the progressives fronted here in Wisconsin?
There were many challenges. Probably the most important ones were the progressives created an important public utility law in 1907. Basically, it's the regulated utility system with a public service commission that we still have today. That was challenged. That was upheld in 1911. The La Follette and the progressives created the civil service system in Wisconsin. That was challenged. Again, the argument was, well, it, only the legislature can set qualifications for public employees. You can't delegate that to a commission. That law was upheld, and that argument was rejected. Wisconsin also passed its first income tax law in 1911. That transformed, really, the structure of our state's financial system, and that law was also upheld. So many challenges, but after Winslow became involved, just about all of the laws were upheld.
Well, it sounds as if he was, he knew what he was doing. He knew how to craft an argument.
He did, and his real skill, though, I think, was he had that rare judicial and political ability to talk to both sides of the political divide. He was universally respected by both sides, and that had a great deal to do with his success in the courtroom, I think.
And he did make a point saying, we really are trying to interpret the law rather than pursue a political agenda. I mean, even today, political agenda figures large in people's perceptions, parties' perceptions in particular, I suppose, of state and federal justices.
I think that's true, Norman. This is an issue that began with the Republic. I don't think it's ever going away. I think it's particularly acute, as I talk about in the final chapter of the book, it's particularly acute today. We live in very polarized times, and the difficulty is courts make decisions that matter to people's lives. They exercise a great deal of power, and anytime you have a body exercising power that's going to hurt some people and help others, that's going to be politically controversial.
We'll look further at the effect of Wisconsin law on federal law when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joseph Ranney, who is a professor of Wisconsin law and legal institutions at Marquette University Law School and a partner in the firm DeWitt Ross and Stevens in Madison, and author of several books, including most recently Wisconsin and the Shaping of American Law, published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2017. I wanted to jump back for a minute before we get to some specific cases of how Wisconsin law affected federal law. And look at the way the whole thing formed in the first place. It seems to me that a lot of states have rather different legal traditions that they developed out of. I mean, the first one I think of was Louisiana with the Code of Napoleon, and then it becomes part of the United States and suddenly a whole different legal system. And Wisconsin, well, the first, legal proprietor of Wisconsin was the French. Was Wisconsin a lawless place under French rule? So, unsettled was it, or what were the traditions?
It's an interesting story, Norman. First of all, one of the things that's unique about Wisconsin and about the Midwest generally is our law was shaped in a fundamentally different way than the older states and colonies on the eastern seaboard. Original colonies, of course, were settled by the British Crown. They were thoroughly under a British common law system. But as you say, Wisconsin actually started out being part of French North America. Wisconsin was white settlers first came to Wisconsin in the mid-1600s, and for the next two centuries, Wisconsin was essentially the remotest part of a very remote outpost of the French Empire. But France had a very different system from the British. France had a civil law system which is much more oriented towards social values in general as opposed to individual rights. Now, I don't want to overemphasize the influence of French law on Wisconsin. The reality is that even up to the time of the American Revolution, there were very few white settlers in Wisconsin. You had French military outposts at Prairie du Chien, Mackinac Island and Green Bay, and most of the time the legal disputes that came up were very simple. It was local fur traders and trappers typically fighting with each other over property disputes or over breaches of contract, and they were as often as not informally resolved by the local military commander or by some respected member of the community who acted as an arbitrator. That being said, though, one should not discount the influence of civil law, even in such a remote outpost of the civil law as Wisconsin. For example, in the 1820s, when American settlers first started to pour into the state in large numbers, there were disputes over land titles between them and some of the old French settlers, and old property laws and land grants made under French government were generally upheld by the American government.
Well, that would be one really interesting case that that would carry through for many of the states, having whether Spanish or English or, let's say, English Crown or French origins, the property laws generally were upheld.
They were. I think I talked a few minutes ago about the Northwest Ordinance, and I'd like to come back to that briefly, if I may. Perhaps the Northwest Ordinance is arguably the most important law that has ever been passed that affects Wisconsin. As I said earlier, the Northwest Ordinance created kind of a unique colonial system. It provided that the United States lands north and west of the Ohio River, what today is modern-day Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, would be formed into one big territory. It provided that as the territory grew, it would be split off into little territories. Each territory, as it grew, they were initially administered by people appointed by the government in Washington. There was a territorial governor who was appointed and a territorial Supreme Court whose judges were appointed. And the governor and the judges between them made the laws. But the ordinance provided that as a territory grew, it would get a legislature of its own. The settlers would be entitled to elect the legislature. And when the territory reached a population of 60,000 people, it would be eligible for statehood. It also provided, importantly, that rivers in the Midwest and Wisconsin were free to navigation and public use by all. That was a fairly radical doctrine at the time.
Really?
And of course, it abolished slavery in the Northwest Territory. So the ordinance has been a fundamentally important part of Wisconsin's heritage. It's really, I think, embedded in our state consciousness, our state DNA, and we take great pride in it today.
I think part of that was also the township system, if I remember correctly, which is the basis for so many communities since then.
You're close. Thomas Jefferson and James Monroe came up with the Northwest Ordinance, and at about the same time, in the 1780s, they created what was called the Land Ordinance, which was the one that created a giant grid system for platting and surveying the Midwest. I mean, anybody who looks at a property title map in Wisconsin today will see the range and meridian system. Basically, all land titles, for many of our listeners, if you look at the deed to your property, you will see it's described as the northwestern eighth of the southwestern quarter of section number 36 mm-hmm. in township such and such, range such and such. That comes from Thomas Jefferson.
So as we have Wisconsin law pretty well established and working most of the time in conjunction with the federal law, nonetheless we have these cases that come up from Wisconsin that affect federal law.
We do. I've been asked, many people who've talked to me over the years about legal history think in terms of, can you give me a top 10 list of what's important? And I confess I think that way sometimes myself. So I sat down before coming here today and thought to myself, what are the most important cases that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has ever decided that listeners should know about? So I'd like to propose the following list of the top four for you, Norman.
Drum roll, please.
The first one is, it's an 1856 case called State ex rel, that's in relation to Bashford versus Barstow. That comes out of a fight over the governorship. In 1855, there was a contest for the governorship between the incumbent, a fellow named William Barstow, and his challenger, Republican challenger named Coles Bashford. The election was very close. The canvassing board, the state elections board at the time, which was controlled by Barstow, the incumbent, certified Barstow as the winner by a very narrow margin. But it was thought that there were a couple of precincts up in Eau Claire and Chippewa counties that had given fraudulent results.
Popular thing back in the day.
Again, everything old is new again.
Yes.
So Bashford, the challenger, filed a suit to overturn the election with the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And it was highly controversial. Bashford and Barstow each called out their political supporters, who called out their local militia companies, and we literally did have two competing governments with rival militia companies camping out on the state capitol. I know many people here are familiar with or perhaps even participated in the demonstrations against Act 10 about 6 years ago, and I remember thinking at the time, well, this is seems like it's unprecedented, but actually if you go back in time 150 years, there was a similar situation. So to continue here, though, the Supreme Court at that time was in disrepute in Wisconsin in 1856. One of its members had been impeached by the legislature for supposed ethical violations a couple of years before. He was acquitted, but the court was kind of in a bad odor. And the incumbent, Barstow, who was trying to defend his seat, argued, the Wisconsin Supreme Court can't tell me what to do. I'm the head of the executive branch. I get to decide who's the chief of the executive branch. You don't. Well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court had to kind of answer to people who thought it was a political body but establish its authority at the same time. So it basically said, it used a very clever rhetorical trick. It essentially said, well, you know, we are just the interpreters of the Constitution, state right. Constitution. We're not political, but our duty interpreting the state Constitution is to say we have the power to decide who's the governor here. And they did, and the incumbent lost. The decision was popularly accepted, and since that time, the Supreme Court's been universally accepted as the body that has the final say as to what the law is in Wisconsin. That case established that principle.
And does that apply federally, too? I mean, it did come up in 2000.
It does. It's actually, there's a famous case which some people learn about in their history courses and all law students learn about their very first year, called Marbury versus Madison.
Yes, 1803.
Very good. 1803 it is. And that's when the U.S. Supreme Court said, we have the final say over constitutionality of laws under the federal Constitution.
In Wisconsin, what criteria did the state Supreme Court use to decide the outcome of that election? Did it have anything to do with the fraud claims, or was it something else?
They took evidence, and the evidence was pretty clear that there had been fraud committed up in Eau Claire and Chippewa. I don't think anybody seriously disputed that there was fraud. The real issue was, who's going to decide this, Barstow or the Supreme Court?
That, yes, I can see where in the long run that would be the more important issue, more important than who actually became governor in 1855, 56.
People were more interested in the election contest then, but the underlying principle is what has lasted.
Another case?
So that's one. So the next important case comes 20 years later. It is called the Potter Law case. This is a time right after the Civil War. Railroads are growing in Wisconsin and they're consolidating. At this point, the Chicago and Northwestern and the Milwaukee Road are basically the two big railroads in Wisconsin, and they are dominating state politics as well as state transportation. Many farmers in Wisconsin at this time are very unhappy. They believe that the rates the railroads are charging are too high, and they discriminate between different regions of the state. So in the mid-1870s, a reform movement very briefly gains control of state government. They pass a law called the Potter Law, which is a very detailed law that sets rates railroads can charge. Well, this gets challenged constitutionally. I talked earlier about the substantive due process doctrine. The railroads invoke that here and say, you know, you can't limit our liberty right to charge what we see fit for our services. So the law gets challenged. And just about that time, the person who is then the Chief Justice resigns because he takes a job that pays him more money elsewhere. And the reform governor appoints an old Wisconsin political warhorse named Edward Ryan. Ryan is another very famous figure, should be more famous than he is in Wisconsin legal history. He is an old Jacksonian Democrat. He is a brilliant man, but he does not suffer fools gladly, and he's not, unlike Winslow, he's not a very diplomatic person. But he does get appointed to the court because it is thought that he will uphold the law, and he does. He issues a blistering opinion that says not only is the law valid, it's a legitimate exercise of the state's power to govern the welfare of its people, but one of the railroad's lawyers made the mistake of using the word communism in his argument to the court. Ryan blistered him, basically said the totally inappropriate use of the word communism is analogous to your criticizing a surgeon for using a knife, here using the Potter Law as a knife to save the political body, not to kill it. So Ryan, the decision is important because up to that time there had been a real question as to whether government could regulate corporations and the rates they charge at all. This case established forever in Wisconsin that the government does have the right to regulate corporate activity.
Yeah, I can see where that would be an important case, especially with railroads being such a powerful entity at that time.
It really kind of laid the foundation for the modern regulatory state, which the progressives built later on. And that brings me, Norman, to the third case. Now, I talked earlier, there's a large number of Wisconsin Supreme Court decisions upholding progressive reform laws. But the one I think is perhaps the most important is a case called State versus Lange Canning Company, which was decided in 1916, right at the end of the progressive era. This is the case in which the constitutionality of the Industrial Commission law, the one that set up the first great industrial safety administrative agency, was challenged. It's an interesting story. Initially, the court strikes down the law. It says the legislature cannot delegate safety regulation making to an administrative agency. But the Attorney General of Wisconsin asks the court to reconsider. So they go into the conference room and they talk. We'll never know exactly what happened in that conference room, but at the end they come out and they reverse themselves. And Chief Justice Winslow, who dissented the first time around, apparently persuaded his colleagues, look, you have to hold this law, uphold this law as constitutional. So that, I think, was kind of the final capstone in Winslow's career. That one preserved the government's ability to delegate the details of policymaking to administrative agencies, and I think that perhaps more than any other case was the key to saving the progressive reform legacy.
And how does that relate to similar cases or further laws in that regard on a national level?
We actually were pioneers in this area. Many other states are starting to enact similar laws creating administrative agencies at this time, but they really haven't wrestled very much with this issue of can the legislature delegate all this power to agencies. The Lange Canning case was one of the first great cases nationwide to establish that principle. And in fact, later on, the Wisconsin Supreme Court built on that, and they ultimately said, not only are we holding that the legislature has power to delegate these functions to administrative agencies, but they said, look, we are going to abandon we have upheld these laws by employing the fiction that, well, the agencies aren't really making policy. They're just deciding facts, like what is necessary to make a factory safe. In 1928, there's another case where Wisconsin becomes the first state to say that is a fiction. We must accept the modern 20th century reality that administrative agencies are another branch of government. I should say, ironically, we're starting to see in this day and age a bit of a backtracking from that. There is now a very lively debate going on both in the U.S. Supreme Court and in our state Supreme Court as to how far agencies should be allowed to go in rulemaking and how far courts have to defer to rules that agencies make. So once again, issues in the law are never permanently resolved. Everything old ultimately becomes new again.
Well, it's constantly changing too, though. I mean, there have to be how many more agencies regulating things now than there were in 1928?
Infinitely more, you're right. But the principles remain the same, just the stakes become higher. So the last case in the top four I want to talk about is a more modern case. That is a 1992 case called Davis versus Grover. Many of our listeners out there may remember it. This is the case in which the Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld the school voucher law that was first passed in 1990. Now, the reason, Norman, why I think that is one of the most important cases ever decided in this state is this. To me, it's kind of emblematic of some of the trends in modern American law and modern Wisconsin legal history. To put it in very simple terms, since the social revolutions of the 1960s, since the Civil Rights Revolution, the Women's Rights Revolution, there's been a fundamental transformation in American consciousness of what the scope of individual rights should be. Prior to the 1960s, we were a much more communitarian society than we were now. People talked to each other more, people shared a consensus of values more, but the downside of that was there was sort of an invisible but nevertheless real boundary over what constituted acceptable political discourse. There were certain, there was a universe of positions that you could take on certain issues, but if you wanted to go outside the box, that was very much frowned upon. For example, back then, people could debate whether there should be discrimination against gay Americans, whether that was legal or not, but things like gay marriage, that was inconceivable. That was not something that people even thought about or would have deemed acceptable discourse then. Starting in the 1960s, that's all changed. We have had a movement toward what legal scholars call expressive individualism, to use the 60s phrase, freedom to do your own thing, whatever it may be. Back to the Davis v. Grover. Expressive individualism has expressed itself in many different ways. We think of it as sort of a liberal doctrine. We think of it in terms of civil rights, women's rights, but it has been used by both sides the political divide. In very simple terms, by the late 1980s, people in Wisconsin and elsewhere had very serious doubts that the program of integration brought about in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education, saying that school segregation was unconstitutional. There was a broad feeling that that integration wasn't working, that it wasn't producing a good quality education for Wisconsin students. So Wisconsin became the first state in the country in 1990 to pass a school voucher program, which basically that you can interpret the voucher program to essentially say the state is going to empower parents through state dollars to make individual choices about where they send their children. The old traditional idea of public schools as a melting pot where all American children would learn common values is starting to disappear. Parental choice to many Americans and many Wisconsinites becomes more important than it was before. And the importance of Davis v. Grover is this was really the first time the Wisconsin Supreme Court had put its stamp of approval on expressive individualism. The court was very badly divided. If you read the majority and the dissenting opinions, there's a lot of political discussion and a lot of very vehement, bitter language, which unfortunately was sort of presaged where the court has gone since then. Another downside of the age of expressive individualism is judges, unfortunately, like many other Americans, are polarized. They are not as rhetorically restrained or civil as they used to be, and Davis v. Grover is an early example of that.
The real key to that case is the use of the state funds to support a voucher program. I mean, parents have always, so far as I know, had the right to do homeschooling, for example. And this was settled in Wisconsin that the voucher program was constitutional.
It was by a 4-3 vote. And you're right. The feature here was people had always had the right to send their children to schools of their choice. They just hadn't had the right to have the government pay for it. This actually had been a battle that had been brewing for over a century, primarily through an earlier debate as to whether the state legislature could provide funding to bus Catholic children to Catholic schools. For many, many years, the Wisconsin Supreme Court repeatedly rejected efforts to do that, saying, no, that's impermissible state support of religion. But in the mid-1960s, the state passed a constitutional amendment authorizing public funding of Catholic school busing. And that again, was one of the things that opened the door for individualism and the idea that not only should expressive individualism be allowed, but perhaps the government should provide some financial support for that.
And what was the relationship between that state Supreme Court decision and federal court challenges?
There were the first two voucher programs. Milwaukee was the first in 1990 through the Wisconsin legislature. The Ohio legislature, a couple of years later, passed a voucher program applicable to Cleveland. The Cleveland school system, like the Milwaukee system, had a great deal of trouble with its integration program, and there were a lot of complaints. The two laws were both challenged. The challenges went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, but for some reason, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear the Wisconsin challenge, which it had the right to do, but it did decide to address the issue with respect to the Ohio law, and it upheld the Ohio law.
We'll look at some more ways in which Wisconsin law has affected federal law when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joseph Ranney, and we're looking at how Wisconsin law has affected federal law over the course of the years. And, you know, we haven't really gotten too much into the personalities of the people involved in some of these cases, Jay. And, you know, one that I think you alluded to without mentioning by name was one of the founders of Wisconsin, and that's James Doty. He was not just a politician, I gather. He was a real estate developer. He also was quite a keen legal mind.
Right, Norman. Yeah, I think most people in Wisconsin at least dimly know of James Doty because we sort of know he was the founder of Madison. But actually, he had a very important role in Wisconsin legal history that not too many people know about. Doty was Wisconsin's first judge ever. Kind of an interesting story. When Wisconsin was first settled, the settlement mostly came from the East, New York and New England. In particular, a lot of young lawyers who grew up and got their training in the East didn't see much economic opportunity there, thought opportunities were better in the Midwest, so they came out here, and Doty was one of those. He came out as a very young man to Detroit in 1820 when Wisconsin was still part of Michigan Territory. He became the personal secretary to Lewis Cass, who was the governor of Michigan. He started his career. He goes in on his first day of work, and Cass says, I'm about to undertake an expedition to explore the territory. Would you like to come along? And he says, sure. So they get in canoes. They go all the way up Lake Huron, through the Straits of Mackinac, all the way across Lake Superior in canoes in bad weather, if you can imagine that. They stop and negotiate several Indian cession treaties on the way. They then go down the St. Croix River to the Mississippi River, and Doty essentially goes up the Wisconsin River to the Madison area, then walks down to Chicago and walks back from Chicago to Detroit. And first major expedition to explore Wisconsin by white settlers, and just an incredible adventure tale. There's actually been a journal written about it, which for those who like travel narratives is very good reading. Anyway, what has all this got to do with the law? Well, Doty was an ambitious guy. And at that time, the three territorial judges for Michigan were in Detroit. There was no transportation network in Wisconsin. If you had a case in Wisconsin and you wanted to appeal it to the Supreme Court, you had to travel to Detroit. The trip alone took several months to get there. So as Wisconsin grew, as the portion of Michigan territory west of Lake Michigan grew, there was sentiment that we should have our own judge here. And Doty worked with Cass. Cass had connections in Congress. He got a law pushed through creating a what was called an additional judge for the portion of Michigan west of Lake Michigan. And surprise, surprise, he managed to get James Doty appointed as Wisconsin's first judge. Very briefly, this being a judge then was very, very different from what it is now. Doty literally had to go through the wilderness and find his own ways. He had to hold court in Mackinac. He had to hold court in Green Bay and Prairie du Chien. And he literally had to cut his own trail between the three communities. For a couple of legs of the trip, he was the first white person who had ever taken that trip. He also had to establish respect for the rule of law among settlers, most of whom had come to Wisconsin to get away from civilization and the law.
Good point.
It's interesting. He, like many early territorial judges, had to establish his authority through kind of a trial by physical combat. And very briefly, another example, Andrew Jackson, not many people know, was at the start of his career a state court judge in Tennessee. And in one of his early court sessions, one of the litigants defied his authority. Jackson had to go outside, look the guy in the eye, hold his pistol up and say, "You got a choice. You either follow my order or we're going to have a duel here." Doty didn't have to have a duel, but there was a case in Green Bay where he fined a prominent local trader in Prairie du Chien for public drunkenness. The trader then went outside. I think he was probably still drunk and starts denouncing Doty. Doty at that point goes outside, physically hauls him back into the courtroom, holds him in contempt, and after that, Doty had no more trouble. But just the process of building a court system, finding
judge
courthouses.
And bailiff.
Exactly. And you got to find local sheriffs and deputies and law enforcement authorities. So an incredibly difficult job. One other quick story about Doty. During the course of his trip with Cass across the lakes, he made friends with several members of the local Chippewa bands of Indians up there. And actually, the Chippewa were part of a larger Sioux Confederation. Doty became the author of the first, and as far as I know, the only English Sioux language dictionary in history. And he became very sympathetic to the fact that American courts were often judging Indians based on American legal standards, which were very different from Indian legal customs. In 1830, Chief Oshkosh, who we all know about the city of Oshkosh, Oshkosh was the chief of the Menominee tribe. Oshkosh was out hunting one day. A warrior from another tribe came onto the land. Under Indian custom, Oshkosh was entitled to kill him, and he did. Oshkosh was then tried for murder, convicted. Doty then made a speech to the court, to the jurors, basically saying, "I hear what you've done, but it is fundamentally unfair to judge this man under laws that he are completely different from what he's used to." So Doty released him, and that ultimately cost Doty his judgeship, kind of a profiling courage for the time.
You mentioned Ryan, too, earlier as being one of the more colorful characters in the development of Wisconsin law.
We've touched on him a couple of times. Edward Ryan comes on the Wisconsin scene in the 1840s as a very young man, and he is kind of on the political and legal stage continuously for the next 30 years. He starts his career as a member of the state's Constitutional Convention in 1846, assembled to create a constitution so that we can become a state. Ryan is a devoted fan of Andrew Jackson. At that time, most people will remember from their history courses, one of the things Jackson was famous for was ending the Bank of the United States. Jackson thought banks, because they amassed so much capital and power, were a threat to democracy. He wanted to abolish them, but he wanted to abolish the currency system with them. He wanted to go back to a simple, purely agricultural economy. Ryan tried, therefore, to put a provision in the Wisconsin Constitution basically prohibiting banks and prohibiting paper currency. He couldn't This was so controversial at the time, even many Democrats thought, well, look, we're going to have industry here at some point. We're going to have commerce. We're going to need banks for that. He failed, and the first Constitution failed because he put that provision in there. He then, nothing daunted, though. Ryan remains on the stage. He becomes one of Wisconsin's most prominent lawyers. He falls out with one of the early Supreme Court judges, Levi Hubbell, and engineers Hubbell's impeachment by the legislature. We mentioned that earlier. That's one of the reasons the Supreme Court had to defend itself in the Bashford versus Barstow case. Ryan then he's an opponent of the Civil War. He's what's called a peace Democrat. Because he opposes the war, he falls out of favor, loses most of his business. He's on his uppers by the early 1870s. But in 1873, he makes a speech denouncing railroads, denouncing new concentrations of capitalism and corporate power in a law school commencement speech, which Bob La Follette, a very young man who's then just graduating from UW Law School, hears. And La Follette cites Ryan's speech as one of the inspirations for his later political career. And then, as we talked about earlier, Ryan, after being down at the bottom, rises to the top, gets appointed Chief Justice, makes this famous Potter Law decision, and becomes, even in his relatively brief tenure, one of Wisconsin's most prominent judges ever.
We have
a very colorful guy.
Woman entering the picture about then, during this height of the suffragette movement, for example?
We do. We haven't talked much about the role of Wisconsin women in the law, but that is a fascinating subject that the book treats at some length. Let me just introduce one person to the readers that perhaps many of them don't know of. Lavinia Goodell of Janesville was Wisconsin's first woman lawyer, and the story of how she got to be a lawyer shows just how difficult it was for women back in the mid-1800s and the challenges they faced in trying to gain rights. Goodell basically decides when she's a young woman that she's interested in the law, and she studies law privately with a local lawyer. That's how you became a lawyer back in those days. The men who make up the Janesville Bar are kind of amused by this, but they're a tolerant group, and they basically say, well, let's give her a chance and see what she can do. So she studies the law. She gets admitted to the local bar down in Rock County. But in those days, if you want to practice before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, you have to get a separate license from that court. So eventually, Goodell has a case she wants to appeal to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She applies for admission, and the court, Chief Justice Edward Ryan, issuing the decision, denies her application. Ryan was a progressive in many ways. He definitely was not a progressive when it came to women. If you read his decision, it's sort of a textbook of the way in which conservative men regarded women in those days. There is a lot of talk about women being on a pedestal. Women are, says Ryan, are pure, fragile creatures who should not be exposed to the sordid realities of commerce and law. They are destined to fulfill a role as mothers and wives, and that's all they should be. Goodell doesn't give up, though. She has a neighbor named John Cassaday who's just been elected to the legislature, and Cassaday, interesting later, goes on to be an important Supreme Court justice himself. But for right now, he decides to help her out. He introduces a bill in the Wisconsin legislature in 1877 to allow women to be admitted to the bar. The law passes. Goodell applies to the Supreme Court again, and this time is admitted, Chief Justice Ryan dissenting. She's interesting, just finally, Norman, she's interesting in that there are many women in the 1870s who are applying, going through similar battles in other states. For those who are interested in women's history, this is an area that not much has been written about, but there are some fascinating stories of very courageous women out there who fought the fight to give women a presence in the bar, and Goodell is certainly one of those people.
Colorful characters and those who became influential, directly or indirectly, in the American legal system at large. A pleasure having you with me for today, Joseph Ranney.
A pleasure being here, and thank you for the opportunity.
He is the author of the recent book published by the UW Press, Wisconsin and the Shaping of American Law. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.